the penultimate lecture. Today, I am going to concentrate exclusively on the avant-garde, to look at painters who you would probably expect to dominate a series of lectures on French painting between 1880 and 1900. Degas and Monet, Seurat and Cézanne, Signac and Denis. Such artists, after all, paved the way for important innovations in the early 20th century. They are major figures in the modernist art history that for the last half century has formed our understanding of early modern art. Hitherto, such painters have played what you might have considered minor roles in my lectures, or have, I hope surprisingly and convincingly, cropped up in unexpected contexts and conjunctions. But on this occasion, they come centre stage. This penultimate lecture is an important turn in the progress of the series. It continues, but more overtly, the implicit argument with the entrenched modernist history of art of this period. This account gives pride of place to independent art and highlights the innovations of heroic figures and successive avant-gardes. The Musée d'Orsay, for example, is essentially displayed according to this narrative. A critique of modernism has been inherent in the lectures so far. If modernism conventionally sees naturalism after Courbet and Manet as marginal or redundant, I have argued for its vitality, modernity, and ideological centrality. Modernism emphasizes the primacy of the avant-garde. While I don't for a moment deny the extraordinary quality and importance of, say, Seurat's or Cézanne's work, nor do I want entirely to disavow the old narratives, I do propose a more critical and contextual approach. It returns to my central argument about naturalism's aesthetic centrality. This brought with it problems. Naturalist painting could appear too value-laden, too tied to the Republic. It could be accused of being too obsessed with the gross material world and insufficiently attuned to subtleties of emotion, suggestion, and belief, the critique of the symbolist elite. It could also seem, with its stress on the descriptive and the narrative, to be too concerned with restricting the resources of painting to the representation of the here and now. The commitment to depicting nature, even though naturalism allowed plenty of latitude, put too much emphasis on mimesis, to the detriment of the possibilities of painting. To paraphrase Zola, too much nature, not enough temperament. In an earlier lecture, I looked at contemporary accusations that naturalism lacked style. Today, I want to argue that for artists who are determined to break its hegemony, the weapon was style. If naturalism's descriptive aesthetic and its ideological usefulness to the Republic pivoted on its inclusivity, style gave the artist the opportunity to be exclusive. I will move along broad lines, ranging widely over 20 years and very different artists. There will be no account of neo-impressionism, the Nabi, or other avant-garde groupings of the time, so I'm assuming a certain knowledge amongst my audience. This isn't to dismiss any groupings, painters, or their innovations, very well documented in a vast literature, but to essay fresh and provocative arguments that develop my thesis, and to attempt to see the remarkable paintings of this exciting period in different lights. Style in the 1880s and 1890s had several dimensions. First, it involved, necessitated even, the manipulation of things seen to accord with the artist's creative will. It was a knowing rejection of the objectively descriptive to make forms which are subjective to the painter's transformation, touch, rhythm, chromatic sensibility, sense of pattern or design. Second, such a process necessarily adapted the processes of looking and making. The artist did not look and paint in order to be correct, but to modify, distort, or harmonize. Technique, process, was pivotal. Third, the search for style required psychological effort. To reject the entrenched conventions of description, to find an appropriately personal expression or style with which to replace them. The search for style, by this account, was a hard road. It was not just heroic innovation. It could be shaped by an artist's own deficiencies of craft, by inability to practice the high standards of naturalism. And there was also the need for work which stood somewhat apart from the norms of legibility, descriptiveness, and other kinds of social purpose, to give itself some justification. For to function outside the bounds of naturalism was, to some extent, to repudiate a broad collective social consensus about how to see and understand the world. One way or another, style had to negotiate with naturalism. We can begin by considering Impressionism in this context. Impressionism at this period is often discussed either in terms of an individual artist's work or within a wider context of avant-garde activity and progress. Questions are much less frequently asked about Impressionist painting in relation to naturalism. Often they are seen to be antagonistic, the inventive against the plodding. But the picture was more complex. Degas' position vis-à-vis naturalism is fascinating, not really understood, and worth unpicking as much in terms of artistic politics as his work. As early as 1874, when he was involved in the organisation of what would be the first Impressionist exhibition, Degas had encouraged Tissot to join what he advertised as a realist salon. 5 years later, he planned to invite Gervex and Lhermitte to exhibit at the fourth Impressionist exhibition. In the event, neither participated, but on this evidence, Degas' concept of these independent shows was less Impressionist than naturalist. It encompassed artists whose painting manifested naturalism's breadth, from Gervex's tidily executed metropolitan chic to Lhermitte's strongly drawn rusticity. With his exhibits at the 1879, 80 and 81 Impressionist shows, among them the daring Miss Lala at the Cirque Fernando and the veristic sculpture of the Little Dancer of 14, Degas' critical reputation was very high. In addition, his work, if not purchased by the state, was in the private collections of prestigious tastemakers such as Charles Effroussi, director of the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, and the critic Louis de Forcault. It was Forcault who, you may remember from my third lecture, in his review of the 1884 Salon had praised Degas as being the originator of many of the most innovative pictorial devices that characterise contemporary naturalist painting. But it was at this time, around 1884, when Degas was 50, that his attitudes to naturalism began inexorably to shift. Between 1882 and 1885, Degas dated an unusual number of works, which may suggest that he was planning a one-man show. The range of these subjects, café corsaires, race courses, milliners, toilette scenes, covered topics characteristically naturalist. Such a one-man show would have been an initiative on Degas' part to make a public statement about his work, its motifs, draftsmanship, inventive compositions. In other words, to vaunt the primacy in naturalist art that writings such as Forcault's 1884 text awarded him. But no such exhibition took place. Why? There was certainly a crisis of confidence in August 1884 when Degas wrote to two artist friends, the sculptor Bartholomé and the painter Lerolle, about producing bad work and being blocked, powerless. We can only speculate whether creative anxieties undermined a projected exhibition or the idea of concentrated public exposure caused the self-doubt. Part of that public exposure was Forcault's identification of Degas as the originator of various compositional devices which had become clichés in naturalist painting. The claim may have been an exaggeration, but for an artist who valued his privacy, The idea of the spotlight, a one-man show, a position of leadership, may have been a real deterrent. But there is another dimension worth pointing out. It may also have been around this time that Degas started to make acid comments about other artists' work and success. We do not know when he remarked that Bénard flies with our wings, a pun on voler, to fly and to steal. But the thought of work that might have produced such comments was being made in the mid-1880s. I've already shown the parallel between Bénard's 1888 chemistry course and Degas' Café Corsaire compositions, and one could draw another between Bénard's 1886 pastel Nude Woman Warming Herself on the left and Degas' pastels of similar subjects like those shown at the 8th Impressionist exhibition that year. If Degas sniffed at what he saw as Bénard's formal borrowings, his snipe at Bastien Lepage was from another direction. Bastien's Love in the Village, on the left, was shown at the Salon of 1883 and again at his retrospective in 1885. Presumably on one of these occasions, Degas muttered, "I see them making love while Pissarro's back is turned." That comment was much more than an implicit comparison with Pissarro's contemporary peasant subjects, which Degas no doubt preferred, like the one on the right. I suspect that it also inferred a critique of the anecdotal descriptiveness of Bastien's painting. The girl holding a flower, her shawl spread on the fence, the lad self-consciously inspecting his fingernails, in comparison to the simpler, less explanatory body language of Pissarro's rural types. But there were many ways of reading such a picture as Bastien's. Gauguin's Danish wife, Mette, was shocked because she thought Love in the Village depicted the seduction of an underage girl. That remark typified how naturalist paintings encouraged literal social readings, thus perhaps a reason why Degas determined to distance his own work from description and narrative. On several occasions, Degas made clear his disdain for artists who, as he put it, had arrived, achieved establishment success. For example, in 1884, Raffaelli staged a one-man show. It included no less than 24 individual portraits made as studies for the canvas of Clemenceau Speaking, to be shown at the Salon the following year. If this veritable inventory of radical republicanism's leading lights was a gambit on Raffaelli's part to position himself politically, Degas balked at such careerist manoeuvring, complaining about the large catalogue Raffaelli had written, dedicated, as Degas put it, to his exhibition and to himself. Discomfort with naturalism's picture-making, anecdotalism and political patronage caused Degas to dissociate himself. Degas contributed 10 works to the 8th Impressionist Group exhibition in 1886. Thereafter, he chose to release work gradually through dealers, very rarely allowing small focused displays. This denied himself the public presence and critical identity he could easily have courted. But it built up a rarefied reputation which appealed to a more elite clientele. His art adapted in parallel. He pruned down still further his range of subject, dropping the urban vernacular of café, café concert and circus to specialise on motifs such as the ballet or women washing. Restricting his repertoire allowed him to concentrate on the core of his art, drawing the body in movement. A pastel like At the Milliner's, made in 1882 and exhibited in 1886, shows the residual naturalism of the mid-1880s. It is marvellously precise in the way the woman's hand subtly adjusts the bonnet to the slight tilt of her head, with her left hand poised, redundant but stylish before her. But it is also evidently a crafted object, even to the point of neglecting exactitude. Look at the very obvious flecks of pastel used to evoke the highlights of her fur-trimmed jacket. But above all, remark the subtle complementary contrast of deep blue carpet and muted apricot wall, a harmonising background surface with evident graphic striations and no descriptive detail. Nothing hanging on the wall, for instance, just a textured chromatic plane. Such a picture can be read in various ways. It is still an image of contemporary life, of consumerism. It's also a contrast of poses. The bourgeoisie's personal and confident, the shop girl's symmetrical as she waits at your service with two other hats, half effaced by the mirror. For there's something frankly elitist about At the Milliners, a snub to the egalitarian collectivism of much recent naturalism. By the later 1880s and 1890s, Degas still drew specific movement. Here, in the great frieze of dancers of the mid-90s, a figure tying her ballet slipper, but no longer movement as part of social engagement. Drawing, Degas said, was a way of seeing form. And by this stage in his career, delineating the body was only a central activity, along with mark-making, chromatics and repetition, in an art dedicated to process rather than description. This retreat into the studio was matched by his career. He made no submissions to decorate public buildings, painted no portrait of a politician, made no attempt to use his senior connections in the art establishment to get pictures purchased by the state, and indeed refused to allow his work to be exhibited at the Exposition Universelle of 1889. In many ways, Degas' polar opposite within Impressionism, Monet followed a similar path. During the 1870s, Monet's landscape paintings were typically social. The canvases of the riverbanks of the Parisian suburbs or the Gare Saint-Lazare may have used heightened chromatics and a broken touch, but this was the better to represent nature's constant animation and the vibration of light. Monet's naturalism encompassed subject as well as technique, for the motifs he painted were generally social spaces, riverside or cultivated land, suburban garden or city thoroughfare. A change came, quite abruptly, when Monet worked at Fécamp on the Normandy coast in March and April 1881. Simultaneously, probably not consciously, he started making the repetition of motifs central to his work and abandoned any notion of representing Fécamp as a social environment. Fécamp was France's largest fishing port, with over 100 boats and railway tracks coming down to the quayside to collect the catches. Contemporary painters like Jules Noël chose to depict its busy port traffic and tourism. Monet didn't. Instead, he opted to paint either on the shoreline, looking away from Fécamp itself, or on the cliffs above the port, using the great chalk bluffs to mask the town and even the harbour entrance. There, he concentrated on natural effects, the wind lashing the waves of a rising tide, clouds gusting over the breeze-blown scrub, honing his ability rapidly to mix local colour and make graphic marks, which together conjured up the impression the environment offered that moment. The artist's temperament, his personal sensation, now began increasingly to take priority over the social, the collective. In other words, Monet's naturalism was in transformation. His impressionist method was further stretching naturalism in new directions. By the application of his rapid handling to ever more fleeting effects, which in turn required a new canvas as each evanescent moment changed, by the accumulation of canvases depicting essentially the same motif under different climatic and lighting effects, Monet extended naturalism's demand for exactitude into new areas of practice and representation. This was neither a steady nor a consistent process. Take two canvases made at Pourville in 1882. The church at Varangeville, mourning effect, has a dramatic viewpoint, the picture space almost filled with the vast cliff wall above which the church precariously perches. But Monet's depiction of the cliff is not conventionally descriptive. It's a flurry of marks and gestural strokes using colour, fleshy and bloody pinks, flashes of yellow, which make for animated painting rather than loyal actuality. By contrast, low-tide Varengeville offers exactly that. Reviewing Monet's one-man show in 1883, Alfred de Lostello praised the exactitude with which Monet had represented the still tidal pools and algae-covered rocks. But Lostello warned that although Monet had exceptional visual powers and his work was much admired for its verisimilitude, the painter could never be scientifically exact in his depiction of nature's colours. Yet Monet's commitment to accuracy was to become increasingly flexible as, like Degas, his enjoyment of the play of colour, touch and texture came to the fore. And, like Degas again, I think that Monet's growing enthusiasm for process, for the fundamentals of picture making, was allied to his attitude to the dominant naturalism. Another 1882 painting, The Rocks at Low Tide, Pourville, there on the left, might be contrasted with Léon Pelouze's Grand Corps, Low Tide, of 1884. Pelouze's canvas is larger, twice as long, as befits a painting for Salon exhibition, but both depict the Channel coast with figures on the shoreline. But there is a key difference. Several of Monet's figures seem to stoop, suggesting perhaps local people foraging in the rock pools at low tide, whereas Pelouze's small figures are specifically women with shrimping nets and baskets. Monet merely marks some distant sails, whereas Pelouze, and you'll have to believe me, the slide isn't perfect, Pelouze defines the lighthouse and buildings of Grand Corps quite specifically. The difference in information is one of sociability. By the early 1880s, Monet was no longer interested in being descriptive or educational about landscape as habitat. He wanted to deal with his responses to nature. He needed a public which would accept this. That painting, that public, was to be found at the dealers' galleries, not in the salon. The retreat from the salon to the dealers was not just to make sales or find a more sympathetic environment in which to show, it was to find a more sympathetic public. Like Degas, Monet sought no state commissions. In this discussion of Impressionism's relation to naturalism, there is another dimension to be taken into account: gender. Berthe Morisot was a central figure at the Impressionist exhibitions, showing at 7 of the 8 between 1874 and 86, and only missing the 1880 show because of childbirth. She and her husband Eugène Manet were also involved in their organisation. As with Monet and Degas, Morisot's work shifted ground. From the later 1870s, it became more touch-based and less detailed. And from about 1880, she increasingly left the edges of her canvases loose, barely painted in the corners. This applied to both interiors, like Young Woman Pulling on Her Stocking of 1880, and landscapes, like Julie with Pazzi in the Robin's Garden of 1881. How might one explain this? It could be argued that such canvases still count as a kind of naturalism. A painting like Eugène Manet and Julie in the Garden of 1883 is a depiction not just of something seen, but of how it was seen. When we look at something, here father reading to child, what is in the periphery of our vision is not as clear as what is in focus. More than that, in such paintings, Morisot's handling often forms an implicit elongated oval around the central subject, curving inside the neglected corners. Suggesting such a format makes the image correspond to the shape of our binocular vision. From those points of view, Morisot's painting, if not precisely descriptive, nevertheless responded to optical actuality. These paintings are startlingly innovative for their time, far removed from the range of painting we have seen, carrying Impressionism into new expressive territory beyond the generous bounds of naturalism. While Morisot's development of this type of painting could be seen in terms of temperament, she enjoyed rapid working, didn't like fussy surfaces or high finish. One might also take it as a reaction against the more prosaic naturalism that was by the early 1880s such an ubiquitous presence. To project her painting yet further from that consensus, much as Degas and Monet were doing in their different ways, was in a sense less of a wrench for Morisot, for she was a woman. She was not giving up the prospect of public decorations, as such major projects only went to male painters. In previous lectures, I've drawn attention to the inherent and often explicitly masculine phrasing that accompanied the language around republicanism and naturalism. That language about the Republic's legacy to our sons, or the virility of his draftsmanship, dealt with politics and its support systems and was aimed at the electorate, men. Morisot was not an elector. She had no direct investment in or influence on the Republican process. Thus, her painting could develop outside it more easily than a man's could. Her scenes of the early 1880s are social only at the familial level. They are not social at the collective. Painted as private responses to domestic life and exhibited at the independent Impressionist shows, Morisot's paintings were by their style and subject a reaction against the collectivist rhetoric of salon paintings. To achieve such remarkable pictorial radicalism, it needed a woman. In the second half of the lecture, let's look at how younger independent painters negotiated naturalism in search of style. One of the leading figures in naturalist painting was Bastien Lepage. Bastien came to prominence at the Salon of 1878, but before his death in 1884 at the age of 35, his work had established a paradigm for modern naturalism. Pauvre Fauvette of 1881 characterises the stylistic repertoire. The light tones of Peinture Claire, a high horizon coupled with insistent foreground elements to reduce pictorial depth and busy the surface. Such methods heightened the illusion of material and visual actuality. And they offered a formula which could be learned. In 1886, Louis Anquetin painted The Old Peasant on the left, which follows Bastien's approach in the pitch of its horizon and emphatic close features, although it doesn't aspire to the density of his surfaces. Charles Ingres had started experimenting with Bastien's example in 1883, and throughout 1884 and 1885, produced a group of paintings of rural subjects which closely correspond to it. March 1885 had seen a retrospective of Bastien's work at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, which not only gave posthumous confirmation to Bastien's status as an avatar of naturalism, but would have reinforced Ingres's adherence to his formula. Ingres's 1885 in the Garden on the left corresponds closely to the pictorial methods of a painting like Bastien's Joan of Arc, which you could have seen at the retrospective. Both have slim tree trunks which lead upwards close to the canvas surface. Both clutter the near space and mask the angled line of buildings with foliage. Both hem in our field of vision, keeping it down in the garden beneath the screen of trees. Much the same can be said of a rather different painting, Corner of a Garden in Monaco of 1884 by Henri Edmond Cross. Cross used a broader touch than either Bastien or Ingres, and his palette was in a higher key in response to the bright, blanching light of the Mediterranean rather than the moist atmosphere of the north. But fundamentally, Cross used Bastien's formula, one that had been developed to evoke the actuality of looking in a hectic visual field. It's significant that simultaneously three different young artists, Anquetin trained at Cormon Studio in Paris, Ingres in Rouen, and Cross in Lille, found value in Bastien's work. Of course, it's not unusual for the inexperienced artists to adopt a senior figure's idiom. But why adopt Bastiat's? The answer lies in what I've just tried to demonstrate. Bastiat's example suited the naturalist consensus adapted for contemporary subjects about the business of looking and newly minted, and it was newly minted and modern. But above all, it was a style. His work could be learned, and his cross-stitch with his Monaco painting adapted. But herein lay a problem. As the anonymous critic of the newspaper Ville de Paris wrote in his review of the Salon of 1883, in every gallery, on every wall, at every step, Bastien Lepage. Today, everybody paints so like Monsieur Bastien Lepage that Monsieur Bastien Lepage looks as if he paints like everybody else. The style was so insistent a presence that artists who valued their creative integrity, like Orvieta, Henrot and Cros, might well eventually choose to put it aside and to try new pictorial possibilities. In the later 1880s, the last two joined Seurat and Signac in the neo-impressionist group, adopting divisionist chromatics and the pointiest touch. Paintings such as Engrand's Norman Farmyard on the left of 1890 or Cross's The Farm Morning of 1893 typify their work in that decorative avant-garde style, so distant from descriptive naturalism. But although Engrand and Cross had shrugged off naturalism for innovation, Engrand's willingness to close off deep space, Cross's play of smoke and foliage across the foreground, the confidence of both in dealing with busy surface textures, drew from the experience of their earlier Bastiat-like work. For young artists in the 1880s, naturalist painting was the status quo. Its paradigms could be learned. It could be accepted, adapted, or rejected. Its lessons might have continuing value. But one way or another, it was difficult to avoid the hegemony of naturalism. By the late 1880s, a reaction against descriptive naturalism and in favour of pictorial style was underway. Its manifestations were various, from the fraternal groupings of the neo-impressionists at the Salon des Indépendants, through Monet's solo exhibitions of 1888 and 1889, where he showed concentrated clusters of similar motifs, to the success of the Puvis de Chavannes exhibition in late 1887. This reaction was encouraged and sustained by the symbolist aesthetic, articulated in the many small artistic and literary magazines that flourished in Paris. But as I've said before, this audience was elite. The collective mass experience of the 1889 Exposition Universelle, which showcased naturalism, concentrated the minds of young critics. Maurice Denis's definition of neo-traditionism, published in Art et Critique in August 1890, was a manifesto for a new painting. Denis's famous first sentence reminded his readers that a painting, before it's a warhorse, a naked woman, or some anecdote or other, is essentially a flat surface covered in colours arranged in a certain order. And he went on to extol the synthetic purity of Fra Angelico, Japanese prints, Puvis de Chavannes, and Gauguin. A constant counterpoint in Denis's text is his dismissal of what he called the conscientious reportage of nature. And his prose is studded with barbed comments about the work of Daniel Bouveret, Friant, Raffaelli, Rolle, Dutaille, and others. What would Gauguin's Green Christ have looked like, Denis winced, had it been painted by Friant? Denis was reacting to what he knew. Given the necessarily limited experience of a 20-year-old author, the definition was largely based on his reactions to what had been on display at the Exposition Universelle the previous year. In other words, he was reacting not only against a certain kind of art, but also against the very art that had the imprimatur of the Third Republic. To reject naturalism was not merely to disdain an aesthetic, it was to question the validity of the moral and social assumptions that went with it. In addition, Denis' definition of neo-traditionism was intended to differentiate the mannered drawing and flat painting of his colleagues in the incipient Nabi group, artists such as Paul Serruzier there on the left, Pierre Bonnard and Edouard Vuillard, from the existing neo-impressionist group around Siopin and Signac on the right. At that level too, Denis' text was a gambit, defining an exclusive voice within the avant-garde. But the neo-impressionists themselves were also concerned to stake out their own anti-naturalist position. In May 1890, the year Signac painted his portrait, his friend Félix Fénéon praised the artist in Les Hommes d'Aujourd'hui for having created exemplary specimens of an art of great decorative development, which sacrifices anecdote to arabesque, nomenclature to synthesis, the fleeting to the permanent, and with its high spirits and magic, confers on nature, finally tired of its precarious reality, an authentic reality. Although apparently supporting a rival faction in the avant-garde, Fénéon's position was remarkably similar to Denis'. Like Denis, he dismissed anecdote, the insistently narrative side of naturalism, as well as the fleeting, the depiction of the contemporary moment. Fénéon's position in 1890, like Denis', was firmly anti-naturalist. In order to state one's claim to avant-garde status, it was necessary not only to have a distinctively unnaturalistic style, it was also essential to distance one's work from the naturalist consensus. But how far could such distancing go? Avant-garde painting might seek to generate styles which broke with naturalism, were dislodged from the descriptive, but naturalism had allied itself with crucial aspects of the modern dynamic, in particular, science. So avant-garde art might need to show it could use science in new ways without taking a naturalist path. For instance, Fénéon's reference to nomenclature presumably meant naturalist painting's instinct for exactitude and typology, over which Fénéon preferred the more suggestively abbreviated synthesis. Both nomenclature and synthèse are scientific terms, meaning the precise definition of chemical elements and laws, and the process by which such elements form more complex combinations. By using the language of science to validate Signac's radical neo-impressionism, by saying that Signac's pictures did not simply list, but subtly amalgamated, Fénéon elevated his art above base naturalism, implicitly crediting a canvas like Signac's 1890 Saint-Cast, there on the right, with a truer evocation of summer light than Paul Saïm's contemporaneous Near Avignon. In addition, he also set up the new style as a rival to naturalism's long-standing claim to scientific veracity. For it was essential that new pictorial styles kept in some sort of alignment with modern mortalité, that they remained legible to some portion of the public. We saw in a previous lecture how Bonnard and Vuillard engaged with the caricatural. Others linked their work with politics. Let's continue with the same two artists as examples. Maurice Denis was a devoted Roman Catholic. The search for simple, synthetic art, defined in his 1890 definition, was to find a formal equivalent to the purity and spirituality of Christian belief. That is why, in paintings like Catholic Mystery of 1890, he echoed the hieratic style of the Friar Angelico Predellas he knew from the Louvre, exemplars both stylistically and morally distinct from naturalist materialism. In 1897, Denis completed a cycle of paintings on the legend of St. Hubert to decorate the private chapel of Denis Cochin, a wealthy Catholic aristocrat. The first canvas of this series, which is in the centre, in this series of religious hunting scenes, The Departure, was again based on a Quattrocento precedent, Benozzo Gozzoli's Journey of the Magi, there on the left. The analogy flattered Kosher, as Gozzoli's magi were actually Medici's. For Dini, style was, in personal terms, an equation of artistic expression and Catholic faith. In public terms, it was the open advocacy of Catholic rather than Republican values, voiced in an overtly non-naturalistic manner. By contrast, Signac was a committed anarchist. Opposed to both what he saw as the ersatz egalitarianism of the Republic, but also to anarchist terrorism, Signac believed humanity would eventually evolve towards an ideal anarchist state, where machines will do the work and people will exist harmoniously as free individuals. In 1895, he exhibited at the Indépendant his huge manifesto painting, In the Time of Harmony, which is about four times as big as that image. Its play of secondary greens and violets, its measured rhythms and balanced groups, all seek to achieve a pictorial harmony which paralleled his vision of an ideal anarchist future. Its motifs, family, education, community, technology, there are tractors in the background, ironically or perhaps deliberately, would have been at home in a civic decoration. Indeed, In the Time of Harmony adapted the spacious modern classicism of Puvis de Chavannes to neo-impressionist chromatics and anarchist politics. Signac reverted to the legibility and sociability of Republican imagery, borrowed conventional classicism in order to counter them with anarchist ideology and neo-impressionist style. Both Denis and Signac, ideologically on right and left, might combatively choose to demonstrate that innovative painting could address modern issues as effectively as naturalism, that ideologies outside the Republican consensus could best articulated by progressive styles. Innovations or adaptations of style in the late 1880s and 1890s developed ways of seeing the world which were a critique or even a denial of the social. If Degas continued to see drawing as a process of observation, for Seurat, increasingly, it became an act of stylization. A drawing such as the great sheet for the central boy in the Baignade, made in 1883-4, retains a sense of the model, of something seen. But some of the drawings for the Grand Jatte, made only a year or so later, seem utterly invented, so concerned are they with matters of form, mass and curve, shape and shading. With the drawings Seurat made of Café Concert subjects in 1887-8, he knowingly borrowed the pictorial formula pioneered by earlier naturalism and clichéd in contemporary illustration. But instead of using glimpses over heads and close-up figures to stimulate a sense of physical actuality and social belonging, he imposed style. The visible play of his Conte crayon strokes, the push and pull of lights and darks, the schematization of figures. This style took a naturalist formula only to entirely subvert it. And this subversion wasn't only pictorial, in the sense that Seurat's drawings make scant attempt to look like, with their stress on stylized making. The subversion was also social, for it upended naturalism's certainties, its allegiance to the material and sensual, its loyalty to the legible and collective. In Seurat's Café Concert drawings, the subject is evident enough, but naturalism's engagement with public life as the collective experience of separate individuals is replaced by its reduction to the uniform experience of faceless ciphers. This went even further than the Grand Jatte, which may have represented social disjunction, but at least identified its figures as types. If Seurat's extension of style to the edges of anonymity was exceptional, fragmentation was a more common new device. In literature, one finds a choppy, rapid-fire, easily diverted quality in Édouard Dujardin's 1887 novella Les Lauriers sont coupés, with its stream of consciousness, and in other writers, such as Marcel Schwab and Jean Dolon. In March 1894, Michel Zévaco published an article on Félix Vallotton in Le Courrier Français. Zévaco addressed himself to two illustrations Vallotton had published in Le Courrier, The Singers and The Strongmen. But he began his piece in prose about Paris, similar to Dujardin's. Violence of colours, brutality of sounds, truculence of illuminated physogues, morbid paleness of faces, striking sway of material on female haunches. Zévaco saw Vallotton fusing realism and imagination, his drawing of a nose or a forehead sufficient to suggest state of mind. Vallotton's subjects were legible enough, their asymmetrical and haphazard compositions owed to naturalist devices, and the images correspond to what I've called the caricatural in the previous lecture. Vallotton had developed his own signature style, abrupt black and white contrasts, stark patterns, simplified silhouettes. Central to his style was omission, no colour, no detail, no equivalents to actual looking, just white paper and black ink, just the materials. But omission demands concentration on the given, and what Vallotton offers are fragments. Scanning his images, we retrieve shards of experience, that enthusiastic expression, this casual gesture, that mincing gait, just as the writing of Zévaco or Dujardin offers us fragments of perception and experience. Something similar occurs in the early 90s paintings of Toulouse-Lautrec. Alfred Laguigne, Bad Luck Alfred, takes its title from an 1891 short story about a Parisian pimp by Oscar Métainier. Métainier used his experience as an employee at the Préfecture de Police as documentation for his plays and stories. So Lautrec's reference to Métainier in his title assumes something of that naturalism, as does his painting's use of momentary movements and the close-up viewpoint. But Lautrec's naturalism, so evident in aspects of his painting, such as Alfred's nonchalant body language, is only partial. Alfred's body is delineated, not described. His jacket and the torso beneath it remain a pictorial void, like Vallotton's blank paper. This partial definition of the central figure throws our attention onto the detail we are given, notably the tight trio of central faces, flanked as they are by two fragmentary heads. Looking at Alfred Laguigne, the eye ricochets from suggestion to observation, void to fragment. Lautrec's procedure was rather different in the larger, more finished Au Moulin Rouge of about 1892. Overall, it appears more consistently painted, but on closer inspection, the garishly lit maquillage of the foreground woman with her schematic body jars with the more modelled and detailed figures around the table, Edouard Dujardin to the left, let alone the four flat figures behind. Au Moulin Rouge discreetly divides into fragments, the handling of paint adjusting to suggest different levels of attention and experience. Seurat's Café Concert drawings, Vallotton's illustrations and Lautrec's paintings are very different works of art, but they all deal with social experience, and three artists found that neither their means of representation nor their understanding of the social any longer settled easily on the consensual and unified, but rather on the anonymous or the fragmented. I'd like to end by looking at what one might call insecurities of style. In part, this continues the critique of the modernist account of this period that I've been developing. At the same time, it's also an encouragement, an admonition even, to young scholars sitting there at the back, and to my peers sitting nearby, to be ruthless in their analysis of the historical and, above all, the pictorial evidence. Let's look critically at some myths and reputations we take for granted, taking Cézanne and Gauguin as targets. We've already seen how Engrand and Cross learned Bastiat Lepage's naturalism. In the late 1880s, they then learned neo-impressionism. But if style could be absorbed like this, did that not jeopardise its exclusivity? Seurat, who in the mid-1880s had pioneered the neo-impressionist technique, optical vibration via pointillist touch and the division of tone, could tolerate the mutual development of the style by affiliates such as Signac and the Pissarros. But he worried when it began to proliferate. In August 1888, he told Signac, "I've always thought the more numerous we become, the less we'll have originality." For style was simultaneously personal, the artist's private expression, and social, the painter's public face and market presence. But once recognisable avant-garde styles had been generated, they were up for grabs. The critic André Meletio noticed this about Cézanne as early as 1896, the year after the painter's first one-man show at the Vollard Gallery made his work known to more than a very few in Paris. Meletio recognised that despite Cézanne's technical deficiencies, his gaucherie, as Meletio put it, he had a vision entirely his own. This encouraged, as Meletio put it, almost textual imitation by others. Let's look at an extreme example of this, one Meletio almost certainly did not know. The young Émile Bernard, who in 1888 had been close to Gauguin in their anti-naturalist experiments with flat colour and simplified delineation, began in 1889 to experiment with Cézanne's most truculent motif, the bathers. The progressive Brussels group Les Vins held its seventh exhibition from the 18th of January to the 23rd of February 1890, at which Cézanne's recent Four Bathers was shown hors catalogue. Émile Bernard was then staying with his parents in Lille, 100 kilometres away. Simple train journey. He must have seen the Four Bathers, for his own Bathers of 1890 follows its main stretching figure and cramped landscape space. But Bernard's canvas, for all the suavity of its contours and even greater stylization, is a lifeless essay in systematic emulation. What do we make of such veering from style to style? One might take it as Bernard positioning himself, repudiating Gauguin for another exemplar, or as evidence of his own artistic uncertainties. In the broader perspective, were Bernard's stylistic shifts evidence of the rich creative dynamics of the avant-garde, or symptomatic of its precariousness, even of its shallowness? Let's end on a judgmental note. In two key cases, innovative style was developed as much out of expediency as invention. In mid-May 1885, Gauguin told Pissarro that his own work was more about reflection than craft, implicitly acknowledging his technical deficiencies. In fact, Gauguin's painting in the mid-1880s was often clogged and dull. If Gauguin had been run over by the proverbial bus in 1885, we would consider him a third, if not fourth-rate, impressionist. One could argue that it was still 3 years later, in the summer of 1888, that his work was still clogged and dull 3 years later in the summer of 1888, and that Gauguin's stylistic break, marked by the vision of the sermon that August, abandoning observation, local colour and a small painted mark for synthetic drawing and broad zones of imagined colour, was a necessary rupture from a practice made stagnant by deficiencies of craft. Cézanne only infrequently wrote about stylistic matters. In July 1876, he wrote to Pissarro concerning paintings he was making at Lestac. "It's like a playing card. Red roofs over the blue sea. The sun here on the Mediterranean is so tremendous that it seems to me as if the objects were silhouetted not only in black and white, but in blue, red, brown and violet. I may be mistaken, but this seems to me the opposite of modelling." This now famous letter was, at the same time as it was an adumbration of a new kind of chromatically modulated painting which Cézanne hoped he could develop, also a tacit admission that Cézanne found conventional modelling, the articulation of values of light and shade, a skill he could not master. Both Gauguin and Cézanne generated highly personal and influential styles by acknowledging their deficiencies as descriptive painters, by working around the expectations of naturalism. However avant-garde style was achieved, and this lecture has explored very diverse pathways, it required an adjustment from work based on a collective understanding of technique, legibility and meaning, to one centred on the personal and the potentially exclusive. Cézanne's bather paintings may have projected personal style, but for many in the 1890s, these pictures were difficult. While they clearly asserted personal style, they failed in the public duty of legibility. Seeing a Cézanne of bathers in Vollard's gallery window, Puvis de Chavannes shrugged his shoulders in incomprehension and walked on. At Vollard's in 1899, the painter Henri de Groux couldn't understand the subject of a bather painting, despite someone's explanation. These were the reactions of artists, neither naturalist, both with distinctive styles, who expected pictures to be legible, to address their public with clear subjects. Pissarro expressed a related view about Gauguin's undescriptive style when he wrote of the vision of the sermon. "I don't reproach Gauguin for having done a Vermilion background. I reproach him for not applying his synthesis to our modern philosophy, which is absolutely social, anti-authoritarian and anti-mystic." For the anarchist Pissarro, it was a fault on Gauguin's part that he failed to hitch progressive individual style to progressive collective values, as Signac did with In the Time of Harmony. But this wasn't entirely fair. As early as January 1885, Gauguin had told Pissarro that while he was a republican, he found democratic collectivity deadening. "The more the majority is uniform, the less it will need art," Gauguin said. For Gauguin, art needed the support of a cultivated elite with a feeling for the irregular. By striving away from naturalism to achieve style, abandoning the republican consensus to appeal to an elite, denying the inclusive for the exclusive, was a strategy rather more insecure than the modernist narrative allows. In my final lecture, I will explore how in the 1890s the avant-garde, unexpectedly perhaps, drew on past art, and how the dominant naturalism reimposed itself on avant-garde painters. Thank you.